Hello again, and welcome to another episode of BitNote. We'll be talking about video game music, but today we've got an interview, and which we hope you'll enjoy. Have a listen. Okay, and now on the show, we've got an interview with Spencer Rydell, who's a video game composer. So as you know, we play a lot of video game music on the show. In the past, we've had interviews from composers such as Claire Fitch, an Irish game composer. But Spencer is from America, and he's right now working on developing and creating great music for games. Spencer, are you on the line?
I believe I am, David. How's it going?
It's going fine, thank you very much. All right, so we've chatted a bit about this before, but would you like to introduce yourself to everyone out there in the on the airwaves?
Sure. I'm Spencer. I'm a video game music composer and also voice actor, sound designer. Not to sound unfocused, but these are all things that I do professionally. And yeah, I've basically given my life to video game music. It's something that I really love, and I love making it.
Brilliant. So before we get into it, can you tell us everyone like how you got into game music in the first place?
Let me see how I got into it. It's one of those things where I don't know if I'll ever really feel like I'm, into it. I think I'll always sort of feel like I'm on the outside, just sort of trying to break into that bubble. But I think sort of the reason I've gotten as close as I am is because I started hanging out with game developers. I was at Columbia College Chicago studying music and spending a lot of my time hanging out with my fellow music students, as you'd expect. And then with this goal of writing music for games in mind, I realized that it would be, instead of waiting for game developers to come to me, because, I'm so fantastic that obviously they should just be flocking to me, right? I decided that it would be better to go hang out where they hung out. And at Columbia College Chicago, we also have the game design discipline. So I started, going to their social events and their clubs. And it wasn't long before I became, one of the first people that they would think of when they would think, who should we get to do some music for us?
Cool. And right now, your main game at the moment is what you're like working on is a game that's actually being kickstarted at the moment. Would you like to talk about
that? That's
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Charlotte Seeker. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. This is a real passion project for me. The developers making it, Joseph Hogwood and Dan Hernbrot of Bear Cowboy Games, are just incredibly smart people. And the game that they're making is just tons of fun, and it allows me to write a style of music that I really enjoy writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I've got some music playing from it right now. This is one of your tunes, isn't it?
Yeah, should I talk about it a bit? Or?
Right, why don't we just listen to it, and you can talk a bit afterwards. Thank you. All right. So that was Ice Boop. That was your game. Your music from the game Charlotte Seeker, and which was made by the friends you've just mentioned. So just tell me the actual first demo level of that game has actually been released. So I was actually playing the game with this music in the background, and it's a very very icy sort of atmosphere and everything. You were saying earlier how like when you had the level, there were several steps you had to go through in order to make the music for the level for the game, and that's appropriate. Can you talk to the listeners what those steps are?
Well, sure. One of the first things you'll notice when playing the game is that it has this sort of 16-bit appearance, but not exactly. It makes a nod to 16-bit graphics, but it also does things that would not have been necessarily possible on a 16-bit system. So I wanted the music to be the same way. So I started writing this song that had sort of this driving beat, and it sounded sort of vaguely 16-bit, but also did some things that weren't possible, like acoustic drum samples. Mm-hmm. But then when I learned that the setting was going to be in this sort of cavernous, frozen interior of a spaceship, the piece just it suddenly didn't fit anymore. So one of the things that I did to try and bring that icy feel is that the melodic voice is doubled an octave above with this this synthesizer that's meant to evoke a sense of tinkling, almost like icicles. Adding reverb with a lot of high frequencies in it to make this hissy, broad sense of almost like whistling wind. And with all, you know, with those things being mixed together, I found that I had this this coldness that came out of the music that helped build the atmosphere. I also adapted the harmonic content of the piece. There's a lot of motion within the harmonies from like direct modulation from minor chord to minor chord that adds a sense of bleakness without being necessarily too hopeless. Giving that same emotion you might experience.
So I get it. So there's like minor chords which make everything seems unsettled to give the kind of depressing things. There's kind of like a something high pitched to give the whole like ice environment. And as you're saying, there's almost a kind of a reverb about it to actually, you know, get the sense of coldness and like whistling wind through the snowy scape and everything.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, so there's a lot that goes into just a single piece. You just have to take into account the atmosphere, the settings, the environment that the person actually hears it in, correct?
Exactly. I have to make the things that the player is seeing make sense in a certain way. I mean, obviously a lot of work goes into making that happen, but if the music were wrong, then the player might think, oh, the music is wrong, but they might also think, oh, these events that are occurring don't belong together, which is all far more disastrous.
Okay. You brought up something else there about this whole 16-bit thing. Now, this is something that we get a lot of in this show, sort of like mm-hmm. modern games that do a classic. Now, Charlotte Seeker is, you know, very like run-and-gun sort of game. They're shooting, you're dealing with enemies coming, everything. And you said it's even a little like roguelike and that a lot of elements are randomized. But, I mean, one of the first things that... So it's a fun twin-stick shooter. But one of the first things that appeals to people when they see the game is it's kind of got this... you said it's not quite retro. You say it's low fidelity, right?
Yeah, that's what the developers, they explained to me. We're sort of having to define what that means because, to my knowledge, games are either considered to have modern graphics or to have retro graphics.
Right.
Our game uses things like particle effects and other things that would not have been graphically possible on a 16-bit system, but we choose to have this pixelated look because of what it means and because of what it implies about the gameplay.
Okay, well, I mean, a lot of current indie game developers go retro because it's, you know, what they grew up with and what they enjoyed. But of course, mm-hmm. back in the time, you know, like in the 80s, early 90s, people weren't being retro. You know, the style wasn't something that they wanted to do. They were forced to do it from hardware limitations. So in all the classic games, you had to do simple backgrounds and everything was pixelated. You could see the squares that made up each of the game characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a very bright but somewhat limited palette. And so people often try to evoke that visual aesthetic in modern games by just, you know, making graphics that were deliberately pixelated, even though ironically, you know, if you looked at the monitor, there were several pixels making up a single pixel. So it's all these modern high-powered effects to simulate something that was an aesthetic that was really only there because it originally ran on very low-powered devices.
Mm-hmm. And this has happened, I mean, through all the media arts, all throughout history. Something really cool will be born out of necessity, and it'll grow to have a cultural meaning that later gets adapted.
So why don't we, to tie this back in with the music, the same thing is happening with the music as well. I mean, back in the classic, you were talking a bit about, we were talking earlier about actual hardware limitations, weren't just dealt mm-hmm. with graphics, but also the actual sound. So, I mean, I've talked in the past about how they're like sound chips and how they had to programmatically create the sound. But, I mean, since you've studied this a lot more than I understand, so, like, back in the day, before, like, the PlayStation era where people could just, you know, record something in a studio and put the song into the game, how was it done before then? With limited hardware.
Yeah, the hardware for these early game consoles, like the Atari 2600 and the Nintendo Entertainment System, was purpose built to produce a very specific palette of sounds. So the hardware code that these guys would write would produce. Let me see how clear I can make this.
Well, I mean,
they would have to send extremely specific instructions to the audio hardware to get it to emit the sounds that it was capable of emitting. And it wasn't so much that they had to like write code that encoded waveforms. It was that they had to write code to turn specific sets of pins on and off that would cause the hardware to emit these sounds. It's almost like it was a tiny electronic instrument and you were telling it how to play your song.
So in other words, I mean, all sound is just made up of vibrations, right? If you look at any mm-hmm. sound in a recording studio, you'll just see a wave that goes up and down. And normally it's very jagged and normally it's a combination of several different things. But in the end, sound is just a vibration. But mm-hmm. back then, these days you could just record something, record the vibrations put into the game, but back then they actually had to have pieces of hardware that would create these vibrations, and that normally be very perfect, like sinusoidal or square waves, and have very distinct sounds, that you're saying, right?
Exactly, yeah. With one of the things that contributes to the very particular sound of the Nintendo Entertainment System is the fact that it had four channels. One of those channels was always going to produce noise. One of those channels was always going to produce a triangle wave, and triangle wave was often used for those signature bass lines. And then two of them produced what we would either call pulse waves or square waves. Oh. So the fact that your palette of sounds is automatically condensed down to that is one of the reasons that when you hear NES music, you can almost always recognize it. Versus Atari 2600 music, the number of channels you had was, if I remember correctly, it was smaller, but you had other capabilities, like the Atari was able to produce vibrato and things like that, which produced a quite different, although similar, but distinctively or recognizably different palette of sounds for Atari games.
Well, so it's like every sound trip was basically its own orchestra, only it was more mm-hmm. limited than an orchestra because it couldn't even produce notes. It just produced signal sounds. And, I mean, the programmer can usually control the frequency of these and you know, which one plays at what time and a couple of other parameters like amplitude and stuff. But at the end of the day, they were basically limited by what this sound chip could produce, and they basically had to get very creative with it if they wanted to produce some cool stuff.
Absolutely. And if you listen very carefully while playing some of these NES games, like an easy example is Mario Brothers, you'll notice when you collect a coin or jump, one of the two voices playing the melody actually drops out, because that part of the hardware gets temporarily turned over to making that sound effect happen, and it can't be there suddenly to play the harmonization of the melody.
Well, okay, cool. So it was out of necessity, and there were a lot of limitations. But because these sounds were, let's face it, artificial rather than something in the real world, they had their own distinctive mm-hmm. sounds, right?
Yeah, very distinctive sounds, and now they have a cultural meaning. The inclusion of these NES and Atari-type sounds into the piece is sort of my way of helping to let the player know what kind of experience they're in for. and also to acknowledge the existence of the to acknowledge the presence of the 16-bit graphics. There is a certain level on which if I only used acoustic sounding instruments and you saw these 16-bit graphics, it could feel like kind of a mismatch. I like to think that I use the old console palette of sounds for better effect than simply than simply acknowledging the graphics, that I can actually talk about the gameplay a little bit with the music.
Yeah, because of course, this back in the day, a lot of these limitations, there were a lot of great songs made with this. So sometimes there's the temptation that some may say, hey, you're just trying to like attract our memory, make us think back to, you know, when really brilliant people use these for creative sounds. But I mean, it's like with everything, you know, something becomes popular, a lot of for whatever reason, as you said, a limitation, but you know, great people manage to use it in a good way and it becomes have a cultural meaning. And I mean, I've played songs like that from on the show.
And I also hope that you know, I hope that I'm not just falling back on that nostalgia appeal completely. When you break it down in a sort of objective way, the actual chiptune or hardware emulation components of the piece make up a small percentage. They're usually featured quite prominently, but they are usually a small component. In the piece we just listened to, I think that the bass line is doubled by an NES hardware emulator, and then the melody comes from an NES hardware emulator as well. But the drums are produced from an acoustic sampling instrument, and most of the other sounds come from contemporary soft synthesizers.
Wait, just out of curiosity, we were saying earlier, how did you be able to recreate these sounds, basically, for your composition?
I used a plugin called the Montag NES VST, which VST Virtual Studio Technology, I think, is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. It's just a piece of software that emulates the hardware of the Nintendo Entertainment System. And allows you to very faithfully reproduce those sounds. And I have a similar piece of software to recreate Atari sounds as well. So it's a rather convenient way to bring in some of these cultural ideas. Again, I try not to rely on them too much, and I try to fiddle around and make sure that I've taken the same care with the implementation of those sounds as a composer who had to do the same with by writing hardware code might do.
Writing hardware code, I mean, just because you're very good at writing hardware code for music doesn't mean you're very good at composing. But back in the day, practically both was a prerequisite. Although, I think there were some exceptions with Sonic the Hedgehog, for instance. Dreams Come True, a Japanese band made the music, and then another guy had to code it all up. But definitely, back then, being an engineer, if you wanted to be a composer back then, you need to be an engineer. But you're saying with the VST tables, though... like I said, so basically over two decades ago, they needed a piece of hardware in order to like simulate all this the sound wave, so that people would hear it. And these days, you're just doing it using a program on your computer away from the hardware.
And then you take what would have been generated directly by hardware, and you create samples from it. Which is basically how all game audio has worked since the transition away from the N64. And personally, I would like to see more of a movement back towards procedural generation of sound. I'm not necessarily talking about bringing sound chips back into game consoles, but I would like to see
generation is when the actual computer like simulates the entire sound wave, right? Programmatically.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Like imagine a somewhat sophisticated synthesizer, and I'm sure that similar things have been done, but you know, you could write a program that would allow the computer to simulate the sound of any enormous number of different objects clanging into the wall. That's one thing that can kind of break the immersion of like As amazing as the sound for a lot of these modern games is, a lot of objects that should sound differently when interacting with the environment have to use the same sound because that's just a limitation that they're dealing with. And if there were a way for the software to produce that sound, then it would be as simple as changing a small set of parameters rather than having to take up memory with an enormous number of samples to produce a more immersive environment.
I think I know what you mean by that. I mean, for instance, the Havox Physics Engine, which is a program that's largely about, you know, items hitting other items. It had this whole adaptive sound system, so that when, like, for instance, a chair hit a wall, it would produce a different sound from the chair hitting concrete or a chair hitting plaster. The whole thing is about, like, seeing what's happening in the game and adapting it to what's going on. Okay. Before we go, why don't I play another track? I mean, at the moment, you've got the one you had, Ice Boop, is for the first level, but you're working on Fancy Rockets also for the Charlotte Seeker. So will I play that one now?
Sure. Why don't we go ahead and play it?
Okay.
Or I can talk about it a bit first. All right, there it goes. Mm-hmm.
All right, that's... Sorry. Sorry about that. So I think it's playing...
Auto-play.
So why don't you just tell us, how did you design Fancy Rockets? I mean, what was your focus with that?
Well, as the developers and I were talking more and more about the game, the discussions turned away from the environments and more talking about Charlotte herself. And so I wanted to write something that I thought would capture what she was thinking about. And so I'm pretty sure that this song is going to end up getting used. It's just a matter of finding a level or a scenario for which it works. But yeah, I wanted to capture her state of mind, and so what I've done to try and do that is the middle section where the harmonies become unusual and the way that they move is sort of unexpected. Those harmonies moving around and becoming sort of crazy and everything's going on at once represents the chaos that surrounds Charlotte all the time. The bullets are flying past her, aliens are trying to explode themselves. But the melody during that section almost seems to ignore the harmonic activity. The melody just goes straight forward, being really optimistic and staying firmly in the major key. So that's her unceasing optimism.
That's very good.
And the rest of the, yeah.
So it has a lot of, it's basically two, almost a conflict of her optimism with the crazy scenario. I think it works. So it, in other words, the music kind of matches the theme of the game. The whole, so many games are about, you know, an opposition, about small person going up against huge odds and huge amount of enemies. And you're basically encapsulating that drive to overcome these odds, the optimism, in the background, in the music for this game.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
Cool.
And then the rest of the musical content, it's I had also been recently listening to a lot of jungle music, which is a combination of reggae and drum and bass. So I definitely wanted to do something that utilized some of those elements. So it's sort of a mixture of that and then some really classic, recognizable chiptune type things, like those arpeggios, mm-hmm. and the somewhat syncopated melodies are, I think, really clear signifiers of the chiptune.
What's your focus? What's your belief about what music brings to video games? I mean, what do you love about it, and what do you try to get? Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you believe that music should do for games in general?
Well, I think in an ideal scenario, what the composer does should be as much considered game design as what any other member of the team does. I think that, yeah, when things turn out really ideally, what the composer does is as important to getting the player to remain engaged and to know what they're supposed to be doing as, say, the guy who goes through a level and touches up the lighting to make it, you know, to make things clearer. And I think that there's no better example of a game that does this than Portal 2, where really acute listeners will notice that the music in that game is so adaptive and so dynamic that it really is leading you to the solution of the puzzle if you listen really carefully. I didn't notice it the first time. The first time I got to the game and I found myself asking, was there music during it? When you go back and find that it's just so sophisticated and so ubiquitous, it's amazing.
I actually, after you told me this, I went and played a bit more Portal 2. And I mean, I have to say you're right. For a start, the music is very electronic, very ambient, kind of almost thing. I mean, it's there if you notice it. But also as you complete the puzzles. I mean, I've noticed sometimes when you go across a jump or hit or slide across the fast-moving gel, it's not so much a sound effects plays. It's more like an accompaniment to the actual music. So what you're doing in the game almost becomes part of the music of the soundtrack. And of course, as you were saying earlier, when you complete part of a puzzle, like put a box on a switch and open up the next part, then suddenly another layer gets added to the music. And so as you do each part of the puzzle, it comes together more as an ensemble to you're actually, you know, advancing the composition by advancing through the level.
It's almost to the point where I'm reluctant to consider the official soundtrack to be the actual music of Portal 2. Because it's almost to the point where the composition and the level design are so unified. They're like space and time. We're done thinking about them separately at this point.
Actually, yeah, I know. It's just amazing how it responds, and the unification is just incredible about it. I think we'll finish off with the music called Splatformer. Would you like to talk a bit about that game that you're working on?
Yeah, Splatformer. This was a game that was made in sort of a jam or a sprint scenario. The team had a very limited time to make it, and so the ideas that I had to get across were that we're dealing with a sort of Frankenstein-type monster, but it's a very sympathetic character, and it's a character that, because it's intoxicated or because it's ill, is throwing up everywhere, and that's the primary gameplay, that you have to use your vomit power, so to speak. So to try e-movie music, I use these tremolo strings, and I have this harmonic motion that that's basically ripped directly out of these science fiction b-movie scores. And then to evoke the tragedy, I have this the tragedy and the sort of off-kilter, unbalanced drunkenness, I use jazz instrumentation and this sort of unsteady loping bass line.
Okay. Well, Spencer, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I think it's been really amazing that the insight you've given us into game music and what goes on to make a great bit of music game composition. I really do wish you the best and I hope you compose music for many great games and great compositions yet to come. And we'll finish off with Splatformer's music. So, who else was involved in the game before we go on?
Oh, yes, my very good friends Ian and Colin McInerney, which that sort of makes them sound like they're brothers, but I can't remember Ian's last name. Sorry, Ian.
It's okay. We'll finish up. Listen, anyway, thank you very much for being on the show, Spencer, and for
thank
everyone.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And to everyone listening out there, this is David Collins with BitNote. Thank you for listening.